This is Fresh Air. I'm Barbara Bogave, in for Terry Gross. On this Martin Luther King Day, we've invited jurist and civil rights leader Judge Leon Higginbotham Jr. to talk about his perspective on race relations and the law in America. After attending segregated schools in Trenton, New Jersey, Higginbotham graduated with honors from Yale Law School in 1951. He then applied to and was rejected by every major law firm in Philadelphia because of the color of his skin. He went into public service and at the age of 36 was appointed by President Kennedy to the federal bench. Judge Higginbotham retired in 1993 after 29 years on the bench, including a term as the Chief Judge of the United States Court of Appeals for the Third Circuit. He currently teaches law at Harvard's Kennedy School of Government. His new book, Shades of Freedom, is the second in a series on race and the American legal process. In it, Judge Higginbotham cites the slave statutes of the 1600s, the Dred Scott case, and Plessy v. Ferguson as examples of the ways in which, more often than not, the American legal process has played a dominant role in, as he writes, substantiating, perpetuating, and legitimizing the precept of black inferiority. I asked him to explain the relevance of those historical legal precedents in today's world.
Well, what it has to do with now is that some of the same perceptions which sanctioned slavery law were predicated on the assumption that blacks were inferior and you could treat them differently. And today you have a significant portion of the society which looks upon blacks as inferior and therefore that they can be treated adversely. I discuss as an example the Susan Smith case out of Union, South Carolina, in 1994, where when she rolled her car down into the river with her two children, went on the air and said that a black man did it. And I have a whole series of cases from South Carolina to Boston where whites who've been involved in the commission of crimes have claimed that a black was involved when no such black was. So that if you look at the current data, in the 1990s, with the large number of false accusations which have been made against blacks, and I have them documented in the book, why do they do it? No one says a Roman Catholic did it, and no one says a Methodist did it, but you have this plethora of cases which say that a black did it, when we learn later they never did. And the reason why that occurs is that you've got a mindset that blacks are still perceived by some people as inferior and therefore can be treated differently.
Well, someone might say, well, what does that have to do with our legal system, though? That speaks to individual racism or even perhaps a pervasive social bias.
Well, I guess it depends on which side of the lens you're looking at. If you were in Boston when Charles Stewart claimed that his wife had been killed by a black, and if you had been in Boston when thereafter in predominantly black neighborhoods, there were hundreds of searches and arrests, and some arrests were made. And if you were in towns where people were literally taken to the police station, that is something more than just a mere legal coincidence. It is the utilization of the law predicated on presumptions of prejudice to treat you adversely because of your race. So prejudice, to some extent, still persists, and it is that bias which is predicated on the same type of thinking which said you could treat them differently and make them slaves.
You grew up in Trenton, New Jersey. Your mother was a maid, and your father was a factory worker. And you were the first student from your segregated grammar school to graduate to the academic track at Trenton's junior high. How did you accomplish that?
Well, you had to have second year Latin to enter the academic program at what was then called the Lincoln Junior High School, an all-black school. But since we did not have Latin, it would mean that I would have to go in the industrial program. But my mother went to see the principal. The principal said it couldn't be done because I had not had first-year Latin. My mother begged him to give me an opportunity, saying she was confident that I'd be able to make it. So I entered the academic program where I started with second-year Latin, not having had the first year.
That's not that easy, is it?
It certainly wasn't.
Well, what had your mother, what did your mother hope for you?
Well, my mother had a minimum education, maybe a maximum of sixth grade Virginia education. My mother was the most inspiring person I've ever known, and she disregarded the probability curve. My mother believed in America in a sense that even with all of its obstacles, that if you give your society the very, very best and that you're steadfast, that somewhere God will make a way. So that she convinced me from the time I was 3 or 4 years old to really give it nothing less than my best. And I think that having a mother who had that type of commitment had a profound impact on me so that I could face obstacles and not feel overcome.
Well, you got into Purdue University, and at that time there were 6,000 whites and 12 blacks, and they had a kind of segregated housing arrangement for the black students, which I imagine sounds quite wretched. You asked the president of the university for a section of any dorm just for the 12 of you that had some heat. What was his response?
Well, we slept in an attic with no heat, and you can imagine and when the temperature got 20 and 15, how miserable. And his response was, look, Higginbotham, the law does not require us to have you here, and you either take it or leave it. I finished my semester there, and I did well academically, and I transferred. And I did more than merely transfer from Purdue, which I'd entered when I was 16 and was studying engineering. I decided that I would go into the law because I wanted to, in my life, make a change so that my children would not face another president such as Dr. Elliott, who was willing to preclude us from equality at Purdue.
So he made you a lawyer?
He certainly did. I would have been an engineer but for him.
You graduated from Yale Law School. You were a star of the debate team. You had high recommendations, and the dean of the school sent you with recommendations to the Yale Law School representative in Philadelphia. Did the representative know you were black?
No, he did not. In fact, he wrote me a letter commending me on my record and said my problem would be to decide which firm I would want to go to. When I got there in December when he met me, he didn't even ask me to sit down. He left me standing in front of his desk, and he said, well, Higginbotham, there's nothing I can do for you, but I can give you the name of two black lawyers. That was the end of the conversation. But I don't want to give a negative on all of these, though all of the law firms refused to take me and refused a couple years earlier to take Bill Coleman, who had clerked for the United States Supreme Court Justice. I did have a great fortune in the sense that there was a Quaker judge, Judge Curtis Bach, who, when he got my papers, looked at them and hired me on the spot. And Judge Bach made a profound difference. He is the father of Derek Bach, the former president of Harvard, so that I would like for you to clearly understand that when I discuss the deficiencies in race relations in America, I am aware of many of the strengths, and I'm aware of the significant number of people of goodwill who have made a profound contribution into bridging the gaps so that the history of the past will not be the prologue of the future.
Later in the 50s and the early 60s, as the height of the civil rights movement, and you were established in your career, you once said of that period that you recognized you had to be a voice of rationality for your generation rather than a voice of anger, that if you want change, that that's how you do it. Was that a difficult decision for you to make or a difficult line to walk?
No, it was not. If you could just turn the clock back to 1968 as an example, when Martin Luther King was assassinated, and you saw the cities burning down in Newark and in Chicago and in 10 blocks from the White House in Washington, you recognize that we were caught in a reaction of violence to the killing of the nonviolent prophet, that America could disintegrate, and so that it was absolutely essential that those of us who had leadership roles would speak jointly by saying we condemned racism, but we also condemned violence, one, because it's inappropriate, and secondly, because it's non-productive. I was confident then, and I'm even more confident now, that violence is not a rational way of resolution, and that those who participate in it in the long run are counterproductive. So that I try to do two things. One, to condemn the racism and the sexism and the mistreatment of people because they're who are weak and poor, so that you make clear that you know what rights they should get. At the same time, make it also clear of my opposition to using violence as an option to make change.
You know, I think about you working every day in the courts, upholding the law, I suppose revering the laws of this country in your capacity as a jurist, and then going back to your office and working on a history of the ways in which the legal system in America institutionalized racial oppression and prejudice throughout history. Was that in some way a schizophrenic experience for you?
Well, for some people, it could be. I look upon it as an individual who worked as a pathologist looking through lens, seeing tissue that was malignant, and then at the same time working for a process so that you can eliminate the malignancy. So that I think that after 33 years of looking at it, that I became more like the pathologist and did not let my emotions affect me, but tried to see what was wrong and then to try to figure out what are the therapeutic or prophylactic ways under which that pathology could be eliminated.
My guest is Judge Leon Higginbotham, Jr. He served for 29 years as a federal judge and is a former chief judge of the United States Court of Appeals for the Third Circuit. His new book, Shades of Freedom, traces racism and the law in this country since colonial times. It's the second volume in a projected series on race and the American legal process. Let's take a short break and then we'll talk some more. This is Fresh Air. If you're just joining us, my guest is Judge Leon Higginbotham, Jr. He retired from the bench in 1993 after serving as a federal judge for 29 years, most recently as the chief judge of the United States Court of Appeals for the Third Circuit. He currently teaches law at Harvard University. You expressed grave reservations about Justice Clarence Thomas in an open letter to him at the time of his confirmation. What most alarmed you about his views and his potential as a Supreme Court jurist?
Well, what alarmed me most was that he had, while he was with the Equal Employment Opportunity Commission, written a whole series of articles critiquing and I think impugning Justice Thurgood Marshall. And I felt that anyone who had been the beneficiary of the constitutional system, which Thurgood Marshall as counsel for the NAACP, laid the groundwork for, and as a Supreme Court justice had pushed to implement, that anyone who had been so critical of him might, when they get on the court, be insensitive to the plight of the weak, the poor, and the blacks, because otherwise you could not explain why he would have been so critical of Justice Marshall.
Although you intimate that it might have been motivated by his political alliance for him.
It may very well have been. He may very well have thought that in order to be in good standing with the Reagan and Bush people, I have to sort of impugn my own people. Well, if he did it for that, that's an even more of a reason why I would be concerned about his appointment to the court. I think that there's nothing worse than to have someone who's been the beneficiary of options to now, in order to advance himself or herself, to now push to eliminate the same options for others who are in as great a need.
Well, what do you make of arguments on the part of whites or blacks against affirmative action? And I'm thinking that some black conservatives argue that affirmative action was meant to be temporary and that it's like treating a patient with aspirin instead of a cure, that what African Americans need are better city schools so that black college and job applicants are truly on equal footing with whites and equally qualified to compete.
Well, first of all, you've got to throw out the myth that all the white people who've made it in this society have been quality people. Secondly, let's look at Newt Gingrich.
Okay.
A year ago, he brought in 65 pages to the United States Congress. Of the 65, 64 were white and one was Asian. Prior to that, about 20% who had come in had been minorities. Now, is Newt Gingrich saying to us that there's not one black boy in this country who can carry a flag? Is Newt Gingrich saying to us that there's not one black girl who can deliver a message? The truth of the matter is, the reason why you need affirmative action is because of the type of process which is run by people like Newt Gingrich. If you don't have affirmative action, you're going to have affirmative exclusion. If you look at what is known as the Sixth Circuit, Kentucky, Ohio, Michigan, and Tennessee, the Reagan and Bush administration, over a period of 12 years, appointed 50 judges. Of the 50, not one was black. Carter had been able to appoint blacks. Nixon had. Ford had. Kennedy had. The reason why you have to have affirmative action is because there's sufficient latent prejudice and bias in the system that the only way you're going to get equilibrium is to have some monitoring so that there is some inclusion. And what I can't understand is that how is it that people can be so comfortable with black athletes getting into the schools, sometimes through an affirmative athletic policy, but the black student who could be a good scientist, who could be a good mathematician, you say that you don't want to have any affirmative recruiting policies for them.
Judge Higginbotham, I'm really sorry we're out of time. I want to thank you very much for talking today.
My pleasure.
Judge Leon Higginbotham Jr. teaches law at Harvard's Kennedy School of Government. His new book is Shades of Freedom. The Smithsonian Institution has just reissued a collection called Voices of the Civil Rights Movement, Black American Freedom Songs, recorded between 1960 and 1966. This is We Are Soldiers in the Army, recorded in 1963 at a civil rights meeting in Danville, Virginia.